Welcome to WDRT's Conservation Connections. My name is Sky Bruce. I am an ecologist with the Valley Stewardship Network, and I'm sitting here in the studio today with Jessica Bizzub and Bob Redko of the Prairie Enthusiasts. So welcome, you guys.
Thank you for inviting us in.
Hello.
So both of you came to Prairie Work in different ways from what I've read. Bob through a deep personal connection to the landscape, and Jessica through a chance opportunity that sparked a passion. Can you share what first hooked you on prairies and keeps you committed today?
This is Bob. I just want to say that I started out basically working on a property in the outskirts of Milwaukee when I was in high school doing property management, landscape management, and I went away to University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, and got a degree in natural resources, and stayed back with the people that I were working for because I had a great job. And I ended up working there 49 years, and a lot of my work involved not only buildings and grounds, but also we had 15 acres of natural area. So I evolved into a person who was cutting grass a lot to one that was not so keen about cutting grass, but more working in the back controlling invasive plants. And from there, I worked with Pheasants Forever as a volunteer for 2 years and moved out to Viroqua in 17. Well, we bought land in 17 and moved out here in 20. And I got involved with those properties. And through that, I got involved with the Prairie Enthusiasts.
Wonderful. I'm glad you're here. Jessica?
Yeah, so I actually was interested in nature since I was a kid. Grew up in Maguanago in one of the new suburbs that was surrounded by farmland and also some untouched woodland and what I assume now is oak savanna, with my knowledge now looking back, but really didn't get into nature until adulthood. So my career path just went a different direction. And then around COVID time, I started getting more interested in nature and going outside, I think like a lot of us at that time, and visited Spring Green Nature Preserve and saw all of the prickly pear cactus, and it blew my mind that there was cactus in Wisconsin. And not only was it there, but it was native. And that's kind of when it dawned on me that I didn't really have a good understanding of native landscapes in Wisconsin and really decided to learn more. And that's when I found the Wisconsin Master Naturalist Program, which, by the way, is a great program. Put a plug in for that. And it was hosted by the Prairie Enthusiasts. All of the program training around me had filled up very quickly. I lived in Milwaukee at the time. And the one hosted by the Prairie Enthusiasts actually fit my schedule. I didn't know anything about prairies and was out at Mounds View Search Thompson, which is a fantastic site. If you can get there, please do that. I mean, you get a sense of landscape scale conservation, which is hard to come by these days. And really, like, despite the scale of it, what really struck me was how diverse things are in a small plot of land and what you can see over time, like in a prairie, just in one season, different plants come up at different times and bloom, and the different colors and the smells, like, it just was captivating to me. And things sort of snowballed from there. I got involved in my local group back in the Milwaukee area. It was the Glacial Prairie chapter. And then ended up doing some leadership work with that chapter and then on the board and then into staff and now in this role as executive director. So maybe a story of how your passion can lead to a new career opportunity, because that's fortunately what's happened to me.
What a great path to take. Well, speaking of the Prairie Enthusiasts, I'd love it if you all would give us a little bit of background on the organization. Bob, can you start?
Well, I mentioned that one of the things I like to just tie up in a nutshell to describe the Prairie Enthusiasts is that the mission statement of the organization, and I'm going to read this, but it's only a paragraph. The mission of the Prairie Enthusiasts is to ensure the protection and recovery of prairie oak savanna and other associated ecosystems in the upper Midwest through protection, management, restoration, and education. In doing so, we strive to work openly and cooperate with private landowners and other private and public conservation groups. So I thought that kind of tied, gave a good overview of the whole organization.
Yeah, so we're really focused on specifically prairie and related ecosystem remnants because they've been disappearing. And our early volunteers noticed that and decided to take action to do that. And they didn't start as like an incorporated organization. They were just a group of people out there trying to save the prairies that they would find and work with landowners to do so. And eventually it dawned on them that their efforts might be better served by incorporating as an organization, specifically as a land trust, to be able to permanently protect those sites. And that serves our conservation mission by making sure that we can manage them. The idea is in perpetuity, forever.
Beautiful. Thanks, Jessica. And how great now that they have you as their executive director at the Prairie Enthusiasts.
I feel very fortunate.
So, Bob, you've spoken about what the landscape looked like during the 1950s and 60s with abundant grassland birds and open access. What have we lost since then, and what gives you hope that some of that can be restored?
I did a little calculation today based upon a portion that I read up on this morning, and presently, when you look at what we had historically as far as prairie and savanna, we have about 0.15% of remaining grassland and savanna compared to what there was pre-settlement. That leaves very fragmented and very minute amount of the existing ecosystem that was out there. And you throw in invasive plants and more subdivisions, it's a kind of a dire picture in many respects. But as a homeowner or a landowner, you can make a difference. And I've realized this. I've lived on three different properties where I did a lot of work to maintain those properties, get the invasives under control, and then had to sell the property. And the people that came in and purchased it didn't quite follow up. And I could see it going backwards. And that's why I got involved with the Prairie Enthusiast. One of the reasons being, as a site steward, I feel that my efforts are going into something that's going to be there forever or for a long time. Nothing's forever, but in comparison to putting all your effort into your little acre or 2 acre property and then selling it and find out that the people are going to mow the lawn instead of having shooting stars there, for example. And I realized that in recent years as a motivation to get involved as a site steward.
Yeah, it really goes to show how active and proper management of prairies is really needed and how connected humans are to those types of landscapes. And so in that regard, Jessica, how does that kind of lived experience shape the priorities of the Prairie Enthusiasts today?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, one of the things I'll say is the lived memory of what these ecosystems are is disappearing. And I really see it as one of our roles is to help people make a connection to, you know, really high quality sites and what that looks like. And we found that once people do that, it's hard to turn back. You get a sense for what that is and what that can be. And you get bit by the prairie bug and you keep going and going. So for us, really, one of our top priorities, you know, arguably the top priority, is land management, because these sites are so dependent on human intervention, which I think for even some of the nature-loving public, that is a different idea. There can be this idea that the best way to care for nature is to not touch it and let nature take its course. But for fire-dependent ecosystems specifically, that's dependent on human intervention and setting those fires and keeping the invasives out. So it's really important to us to keep doing that and to keep having that human connection through time. And regardless of what organization is there, really conservation is something that's passed down person to person. And that's part of why our volunteer network is so important.
Thank you. And I wanted to talk about a specific site that, Bob, you've talked about and worked on, and that is the Irish Drive Prairie.
Go ahead.
So the Irish Drive Prairie went from being heavily overgrown to supporting a remarkable number and diversity of native plants. And so what does that transformation look like on the ground? And what role do volunteers play in making that happen?
Well, let me just say that the property was purchased in 2016, and there was a lot of work put in by the previous people before me. They took out a lot of invasives and a lot of opened up areas where it was previously overgrown with invasives, and it's through the work of volunteers, it has really started to shape up. It's a 100-acre property south of Gaze Mills, and one of the reasons I got involved over there is because it's close to my residence. It's only a 30-minute drive for me in comparison to going 45 or hour and a half to various other properties. So it was a convenient place to work. And you go down, and I like fishing out here. I like going down to the Mississippi, but I don't like going down and having 100 boats out there. I go to Irish Drive, I have the place to myself, and that is great. And the volunteers that show up also have the place to themselves, because you don't have the congestion that you get with a lot of other popular activities. And the work that we put in is benefiting the site to remain a remnant site and keeping the invasives out and encouraging those genetics of the native plants that are there. So that's one of the reasons I got involved, and I find it very fulfilling to do that.
Well, I love that story, and I think it's a great story of a recent success. And if folks want to read more about that, there's a story on Facebook. I believe it's on the Prairie Enthusiasts page. You can read more about Irish Drive Prairie. So, Jessica, you've talked about being fascinated by the diversity packed into a small prairie area. And for listeners who may not have experienced one, what makes prairies so ecologically unique and important?
Yeah, this is the kind of question that I would love to punt to our ecologist, Dan Carter. My knowledge here is limited, and I am a budding enthusiast still. I consider myself very much in the learning phase. But I believe that a small area of prairie is more ecologically diverse than a small area of the rainforest by comparison. So in terms of your bang for your buck, prairies are fantastic for biodiversity. And by the way, if you care about biodiversity, you care about native habitat. They are essentially the same thing. And just the number of plants that prairies support and the number of species that are dependent on those plants, that's really unique. And once they're gone, you don't get them back. And we are still learning about all the interactions between the plants and the soils and the fungi community, and there's still a lot to learn there. So it's a fascinating field to me.
Yeah, and there is so much to that question and answer, so thank you. On the note of the Prairie Enthusiasts and its volunteers, the Prairie Enthusiasts is known for being deeply volunteer-driven. So what does it look like for everyday people to get involved, and why is that model so powerful for conservation? I'll ask you first, Jessica, and then you, Bob.
Yeah, I kind of think of the structure of the Prairie Enthusiasts as like a spear. And I like a spear rather than an iceberg, because a spear is directional and intentional. And like the tip of the spear are our chapters, and that's how local communities can get involved, whether that's with directly caring for a prairie site or a savanna or other fire-dependent ecosystem. You can also get involved by, getting involved in your chapter's leadership and its management. You can do outreach events, tabling events, presentation-type events, and that's all happening locally and with our chapters. And the real benefit there is that those chapters can tailor things to their communities, what the opportunities are, what the needs are. And we've got 13 chapters, and they all do things differently and have different focuses. And that is challenging as an administrator. But in terms of like our impact on the ground, I think it's a real strength. And so people can get involved by connecting to a site like Bob did. And that's a really great way to do it, and you get to learn about things. But there are many different roles to play with the prairie enthusiasts, and really just encourage people to get out there. We're a friendly community, and you get to learn a lot.
Yeah, and Bob, from your perspective, what has volunteering looked like?
Well, when I was a site steward, I was looking at ways to get people involved. And, you know, people are reluctant to use herbicide. They're reluctant to burn. They're reluctant to use chainsaws if they're just starting out. The best way to start out, I have found, is to have a seed collecting day. And this fall at Irish Drive, every Saturday from 9 till noon, we would get volunteers over there collecting seeds from the remnants on the prairie. The same genetics, we're not bringing in outside genetics, we're keeping the genetics that are there from the plants that evolved on that site. And we collected seed from about mid-August until just about mid-November. And that seed was taken down and processed, and we frost seeded it in a former crop field. And frost seeding allows the seed to be worked into the soil with a freeze and thaw cycle. And eventually we're going to extend the 7 acres of crop field gradually into the remnant prairie. And that is great because people can go out and pick seed and have a good time. They get to know people. We've had some bonding going on now. People that were reluctant to get involved are suddenly regulars showing up every Saturday. And that is, I think, the best way to get for people to get involved. And not only that, but for them to learn plant material. Because they go through and they say, now what seed is this? What plant is this? And they're suddenly becoming more and more involved with the prairie. And it's the best way, I think, for people to get involved.
I'll second that. That was my first volunteer activity, was doing seed collecting. And it's just such an accessible activity. You don't have to know how to use tools. Like, you've got your hands in a bucket, essentially. And that's really accessible. And you get to learn about the plants. And like you said, I think people are reluctant to use power tools, for sure, even hand tools at the beginning if they don't know anything, whereas collecting seeds feels like a very gentle, easy entryway, and I highly encourage people to do it.
And as a site steward, I was involved with Trout Unlimited in the 70s, and we would have work days, and people would come out and pick up a chainsaw, and I could tell when they picked it up, they never ran one before. And I want to know the people that I'm working with on a crew basis, their training. And so it kind of eliminates just opening it up to a day in which, okay, we're going to go out and cut brush. And you get people out there that have never run a chainsaw before or never took chainsaw certification. And so seed collecting is probably the safest, you know.
Yeah, a great gateway into the learning the rest of the tools in prairie restoration. I love that. Definitely encourage listeners to get involved that way if you've never done it before. So, relatedly, Bob, as a site steward, you're the eyes and ears on the ground, and Jessica, you're helping guide the organization statewide. So how do these local efforts and broader leadership efforts come together to create lasting change on the landscape?
Yeah, maybe I'll continue the spear analogy because I kind of left it at the tip there. So, like I said, I think the chapters are the tip of the spear in terms of our local impact, but all of that is supported by committees and staff. And so the outreach materials and that is created by staff and through committees. And beyond that, you know, we've got, you know, we are an accredited land trust, which means that we are doing our protection process in a certain way, and making sure that we've got our documentation in order. So that's what staff help with. You know, also you need, you know, even further behind the scenes, further back on that spear, are things like solid accounting, HR, those types of activities. And they're much less visible to people, and you know, much less visible to our volunteers. But all of that supports that work in the field. And, you know, we now hold significant land assets. And so all of that administrative work helps us secure that for the future, where that allows that work in the field to actually be protected for the long term.
And the volunteerism out on the site steward aspect of it bring a lot of people in that entryway and eventually they'll work their way up and become, who knows, chapter president or get on a board or work their way up in the organization financially, giving financial support. That's another aspect. This year at the conference, we had 200 people that took the Burn School. And that when I was at Stevens Point in the 70s, there was, at Natural Resources, there was very little, if any, discussion when it came to prescribed fire. Now, they've got a burn crew up there, and they're burning a lot, and it's brought in the curriculum. It's changing, hopefully for the better.
Yeah, and to that end, you know, prescribed burning is a huge part of our one of our management. Tool is a tough word for us, but it's really important for our management work. And, you know, the back end of that is making sure that we are insured for that. And then just the level of documentation that we have to do that allows us to do that in the field.
Yes, prescribed fire is such an important tool in prairie management. And so how do you explain its role to people who might be unfamiliar or even a little bit nervous about it?
I can start, and Bob, you can jump in if you want to. I've a couple roles here. I mean, actually, we've got like a really great series of articles in the Prairie Promoter by our ecologist, Dan Carter. But a couple things I want to say about that. We do prescribe burning in the dormant season to try to protect the plants that we're trying to protect. And the idea is, you know, these are sun-loving communities, plant communities. And so if you have, you know, dead plants creating a lot of thatch coverage, that begins to snuff them out. And then the more cool season and things that can tolerate more shade will begin to take precedence on that site. And so part of the role of prescribed burning is to remove that thatch. The other part of it, people often think of burning as a way of recycling nutrients back in, but here we're actually trying to get rid of those nutrients by having the nitrogen carried away. Many of the fire-dependent ecosystems are actually nutrient poor, and we don't want that to be recycled back into the soil because, again, that encourages plants that we don't want to encourage. So fire helps us do that too.
The other thing that enters in with the fire aspect is that a lot of the invasive plants evolved in Europe or Eurasia. Buckthorn, honeysuckle, garlic mustard, they're European in nature. I mean, that's where they came from. So they didn't evolve with fire like our plants have. So a lot of our natives, or most all of our natives, evolved with fire. That's part of their genetics, or their not genetics, but it's been built into them genetically. They've evolved with it. Where you go, if you can go in and burn, those invasives are less likely to dominate.
And when you do prescribe fire to alleviate some people's concerns who might be nervous about this, what are some of the precautions you take in terms of choosing a day to burn and tools you have with you, anything else that comes to mind?
Yeah, so it's called prescribed fire for a reason, because we have a prescription. And so that involves the weather forecast. So you're looking for a certain range of temperatures, a certain range of humidity levels, a certain wind direction, especially if there's a road nearby, you don't want the smoke to carry over that road. So just off the get-go, right, you're looking for a certain set of weather conditions that are conducive to this, to doing this safely. And then also you're trying to burn a specific unit, and you're going to have a break around that unit, and there are, you know, provisions for how big that break needs to be compared to what the fuel loads are, like how long they are, and what the danger is of them getting out of that unit. So you're doing a lot of preparation that way. There's a lot of things that happen behind the scenes to make sure that it's a good situation to burn in. And then everybody on our prescribed burns are trained. And there is a kind of military hierarchy where you have a burn boss who is, you know, deciding whether or not it's a go on that day, just based on the conditions on that day. And they're the ones who are calling the shots. And then you've got crew leaders who are directing the crew, and everyone's got safety gear on. And then we know what to do if the fire gets out of that unit. And if it gets out of our control, we've already alerted the authorities, and so they're aware that the fire is going and that there may be an escape, though, knock on wood, that's very uncommon for us. But yeah, from start to finish, we try to really make sure that it's safe and it's going to be, we're going to be putting fire exactly where we want the fire to be and nowhere else.
What are some of the biggest challenges you're facing right now in prairie conservation, whether that's invasive species, funding for your work, or engaging the next generation?
Can we say all of the above?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we had a burn at Irish Drive last year, and out of the 10 people that were there, five were over 70 years of age, hauling water around. We need younger people getting involved, and that's one of the things we're working on. And we're getting there, I think. We're making some progress. We're also working to get burn bosses trained. The requirements for prairie enthusiasts is they need 50 burns under their belt to become a burn boss. Well, that's a lot of time and education being put in.
Yeah, and I think to that point of yours about getting younger people involved, I think it's related to something that we talked earlier, which is that, you know, the lived experience of what prairie is becoming a rarer thing. And so we really need to get people out on these sites to experience it themselves. You can't care for something if you're not aware of it. And you can't be aware of it unless you've experienced it. And so I think that's where we have to head with that.
Yeah. So in terms of advice to landowners, for landowners in Wisconsin who might have a field or pasture or marginal land, what is one realistic first step they could take towards supporting prairie habitat on their land?
I think they can start by reading. If they go to Nelson Ag, I usually take the prairie promoter over there and leave a bunch at the counter. And you want to pick one up and read it and get involved. You could join Prairie Enthusiasts, and I believe you pay $10 or nothing and you become a member.
Yeah, a donation of any amount makes you a member, and then you get the Prairie Promoter in your mailbox, but the electronic versions are available on the website. There's a lot of good resources out on the internet about getting prairie started in an old ag field. In fact, I believe Rich Henderson, who is one of our volunteers and site stewards, has a YouTube video specifically about this, and go ahead and Google that. I'd highly encourage you to do that.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much for your time here in the studio with Conservation Connections. It's been great to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us in.